Chapter 21. The Steel Casket. Seattle had played out. It was 1958. My stepfather died, leaving Mama all alone back in California. Her letters were full of grief and loneliness. I had blown down to Rachel and the young hash slinger I turned out. I had put on 50 pounds since I kicked the habit. I weighed more than 200 pounds. Time had scissored away my hair in front. I didn't look much like the mugshot of that sleek escapee. I smoked a little gangster and snorted cocaine now and then. I actually copped a cap of H once with my C. I wanted to mix it in a speedball. It was hard to flush the H down the drain. At almost 40, I was ancient as a pimp. I looked like a fat black seal in my expensive threads. For the first time in many years, I had rediscovered my appetite for good food. I was slowing down. I spent most of my time reading in bed. The end of my pimping career wasn't far in the future. I made the decision to go back to the fast track. I stayed away from old haunts. I had put my two girls to work in the street near downtown. Most of their tricks were white. I stayed in a nice hotel nearby. They lived together in the same hotel. 3 months after I got back, a fire changed my pimping setup. The change set up the chain of events that busted me for the escape. I was taking a walk. I stopped to watch flames gut an apartment building. An old brown-skinned stud was watching beside me. He was a sure-shot craps hustler. He also sold working togs to whores and houses in 10 states. After the fire, we went and had a drink together. We liked each other right away. For the next month, we saw each other every day. I started going with him to the whorehouses to peddle his merchandise. I'd always had contempt for whores who worked houses. They gave up 50% of the scratch to a madam. I'd always believed a good whore went to the street to meet the trick. Even when I had the houses in Ohio, my whores got their tricks in the street. Lazy half-ass whores worked houses and let the trick come to them. My friend, Benham Big, convinced me whorehouses were the thing for me. His points were that the wear and tear on a pimp was less. The houses were protected, and the madams were responsible for falls. Also, a girl didn't need the complicated turnout for houses. A pimp's blows would be at least 50% less in the houses. He told me at my age, I can grind up a bankroll in the houses. Then, I can open up a couple of my own and live to get 100 years old. I wouldn't live that long under the stress and strain of the street. 2 months later, I had both my girls in houses. I got my scratch every Monday and money orders by registered mail. Just like he said, it was an easy way to pimp. The 50% off the top, I couldn't miss. I never had it. The girls would work maybe a month or two before coming in to visit me. I spent the time between with Betham Big. He was a real pal. He blew his top when I ignored his advice and tapped almost out for a new 59 hog. I loved him like a father. He knew all the percentages on craps and people. His friendship and wisdom maybe helped me to stay away from H. Maybe if I hadn't gone to jail, I would have gone back to it. I was tempted 12 times. I moved Stacy, the younger whore, to a house in Montana. It was March. She was up there for the season. This meant every 6 weeks or so, I'd have to go up there to service her and tighten my game. She was lonesome. She'd call and write to me how much she missed me. She fell out with the madam and started working in a house run by a stud in the same town. I told Bet I was going up to visit her. He said, Ice, you can't take good advice. You were a sucker to go broke on that hog. Now, here's more good advice. Ice, not only should you not go up there, you better pull that fine bitch out of there. I know that stud. He's a snake. Pull her out. I know a spot in Pennsylvania just as good. Inside of 2 days, you can pull her and place her. I didn't take his advice. I took a train up to visit her. I rented a room in a motel. I registered as Johnny Cato. It was on the outskirts of town. The only Negroes ever in town were whores in houses and pimps come to visit them. She'd come to the motel in early morning after work. She confessed to me that she woke up one day and found her boss in bed with her. In her alarm, she struck him on the head with a heavy brass clock. It didn't chill him. He wiped the blood away and gave her 50 slats to get his rocks. He begged her to quit me and be his woman. It was a bitch of a time to tell me. It was the third and last day of my visit. It was Sunday night around 9. She didn't work Sundays. We were playing around. I had my pajamas on. I had a cap of C in a pocket. I was just lighting a cigarette when a roller-type knock shook the door in me. I went to the door. I said, "Yes, who is it?" He said, "Police, open the door." I opened it. It was two red-faced Swede rollers. One was porcine, the other lanky. I put my shaking hands into the pajama pockets. My fingertips touched the scorching hot cap of cocaine. I hoped I was keeping the fear out of my face. I gave them a wide, toothy smile. They came in and stood in the middle of the room. Their eyes were racing about the room. Stacy was open-mouthed in the bed. I said, "Yes, gentlemen, what can I do for you?" The lanky one said, "We want to see your ID." I went to the closet and got the phony Johnny Cato Fredrickson ID. I put it in his palm. I felt cold sweat running down my back. They looked at it, then looked at each other. Lanky said, "You are in violation of the law. You signed the motel register improperly. Why didn't you sign your full name? What are you trying to hide? What are you doing here in town? It says here you're a dancer. We don't have a club in town that books entertainers." I said, "Officers, my professional name is Johnny Cato. I've got nothing to hide. My full name has always been too long for the marquees. I've fallen into the habit of using the shorter version. My legs went out last year. I don't dance anymore. My wife and I decided to go into business. We are making a tour of this part of the country. We think that in your town, we found the ideal site for a Southern Fried Chicken Shack. My wife has a secret recipe that should make us rich up here." Porky said, "You're a goddamn black lying son of a bitch. Every one of you niggers come up here to open another cat house or suck your whore's pussy. You and that bitch aren't married. You're a low-life pimp, and she's your whore. I've seen her around. I'm telling you, boy, get your nigger ass out of town. We don't want you here." I said, "Yes, sir. I'll forget about the restaurant like you say." They turned and walked out. I knew Stacy's boss had put his finger on me. It was too late to catch the train back to the city. There was one a day at 8 p.m. I knew they'd be back. I was trapped. I'd heard radio bulletin warnings that the highways were snowed under. I couldn't even walk out of town. I snorted the sizzle and sat trying to figure a way out. The chief of police came back at 3 the next afternoon. I let him in. He said, "Boy, I'm not satisfied. I'm going to forget about the phony registration. Now there's a more serious matter. If you and this young woman aren't legally married, you've broken a law I can't overlook. When and where were you married?" I thought fast. I tried to remember a courthouse fire from the newspapers. I couldn't. I said, "Sir, we were married 3 years ago in Waco, Texas. I just can't understand why you doubt we're married." He said, "I'm gonna take you in. I'm going to check your story. If you're telling the truth, I'll let you go. If not, you'll get a jail sentence." He took us down. We were mugged and fingerprinted. Afterwards, we were taken to his office. He said, "Boy, you lied to me. I called Waco. There's no record of your marriage." They locked us up. An hour later, we walked out on $200 bond each. We got a cab to the motel. I understood the bond delay. The joint had been searched. We got her stuff from the whorehouse and sat in the train station until 8 p.m. We got back to the city early that morning. I knew when my fingerprints got to Washington, the FBI would rush back the news I was a fugitive. I had to get out of town. The police chief knew my destination when I left his town. Bedham Big called Pennsylvania. Stacy was parked, ready to leave for the new spot the next day. The chief must have flown my fingerprints to Washington. The city rollers, with a captain of guards from the joint, busted Stacy and me. I was held for the escape. Stacy was harboring me. There was one angle I couldn't figure. All the way to the lockup, it bothered me. How did the city police and that screw know just where in that big city to put their hands on me? I had been transferred to county jail when I figured it out. I have made many stupid mistakes in my life. None was more stupid than the one that put me back in the shithouse. I had a letter in my bag from Stacy. The rollers that searched our room while we were in jail made a notation of my city address. I had played the hick coppers cheap, and here I was with my balls in the fire. Rachel rushed to me from the whorehouse. I fought the charge of escape. After all, they couldn't prove it to the extent that they could tell in the court how I escaped. At my first hearing, I told the judge I hadn't escaped. I told him one night before midnight, a screw unlocked the cell and took me to the front gate and released me. I had a friend who had supplied the scratch for the underground release. It was a very thin story, but it was strong enough to forestall my return to the joint. I was sure bad things would happen to me back there. Bet visited me. He offered to do anything for me. I was lost. No one could help me. Mama came from California to visit me. She was sick and old. In fact, she was dying. She had heart trouble and diabetes. I don't see how she made the trip. It was an old scene. I was in a barred cage. She was crying on the outside of it. She sobbed, "Son, this is the last time we are going to see each other. Your mama's so tired. God gave me the strength to make the long trip to see my poor baby before I go to sleep in Jesus' arms. Son, it's too bad you don't love me as much as I love you." I was crying. I was squeezing her thin, pale hands in mine between the bars. I said, "Now look, Mama, you know we all got Indian blood in us. Mama, you ain't gonna die. Mama, I'll live to get 100 like Papa Joe, your father. Come on now, Mama, stop it. Ain't I got enough worry? Mama, I love you, honest, Mama. Forgive me not writing regular and stuff like that. I love you, Mama, I love you. Please don't die. I couldn't take it while I'm locked up. I'll take care of you when I get out. I swear it, Mama. Just don't die, please." The screw came up. The visit was over. His hard face softened in pity as he looked at her. He knew she was critically sick. I watched her move slowly away from me down the jail corridor. She got to the elevator. She turned and looked at me. She had a sad, pitiful look on her face. It reminded me of that stormy morning long ago. She had stood in the rain and watched the van taking me to my first prison bit. I get a terrible lump in my throat even now when I relive that moment. A week passed after Mama visited me and went back to California. I went into court for the third and last time. The judge ordered me into the custody of the joint's captain of screws. Stacy was released. The captain and his aide were grimly silent. Their prison sedan sliced through the sparkling April day. I was on the rear seat. I gazed at the scurrying, lucky citizens on the street. I wondered what they'd use on me at the joint, rubber hoses or blackjacks. I felt so low. I wouldn't have cared if I'd dropped dead right on the car seat. We went through the big gate into the joint. The warm April sun shone down on the ancient, grimy buildings. The yard cons leaned on their brooms. They stared through the car window at me. The sedan came to a stop. We got out. They took off my handcuffs. I was taken into the same cell house from which I had made the escape 13 years before. I was locked in a cell on the flag. In the early afternoon, a screw marched me to the office of the chief of the joint security. He looked like a pure Aryan stormtrooper sitting behind his desk. He didn't have a blackjack or rubber hose in his hand. He was grinning like maybe Herr Schickelgruber at the railroad coach in France. His voice was a lethal whisper. He said, "Well, well, so you're that slick black bird who flew the coop. Cheer up. You only owe us 11 months. You're lucky you escaped before the new law. There's one on the books now. It penalizes escapees with up to an extra year. Ah, what a shame it isn't retroactive. I am going to put you into a punishment cell for a few days. Nothing personal, mind you. Hell, you didn't hurt me with your escape. Tell me confidentially, how did you do it?" I said, "Sir, I wish I knew. I am subject to states of fugue. I came to that night, and I was walking down the highway a free man. Sir, I certainly wish I could tell you how I did it." His pale, cold eyes hardened into blue agates. His grin widened. He said, "Oh, it's all right, my boy. Tell you what, you're a cinch to get a clear memory of just how you did it before long. Put in a request to the cell house officer to see me when you regain the memory. Well, good luck, my boy, till we meet again." A screw took me to the bathhouse. I took a shower and changed into a tattered con uniform. The croaker examined me, then back to the cell house. The screw took me to a row of tiny, filthy cells on the flag. My first detention cell was on the other side of the cell house. The screw stopped in front of a cell. He unlocked it. He prodded me into it. It was near the front of the cell house. I looked around my new home. It was a tight box designed to crush and torture the human spirit. I raised my arms above me. My fingertips touched the cold steel ceiling. I stretched them out to the side. I touched the steel walls. I walked 7 feet or so from the barred door to the rear of the cell. I passed a steel cot. The mattress cover was stained and stinking from old puke and crap. The toilet and wash bowls were encrusted with greenish-brown crud. It could be a steel casket for a weak skull after a week or two. I'd wondered how long they'd punish me in the box. I turned and walked to the cell door. I stood grasping the bars, looking out at the blank cell house wall in front of me. I thought, the Nazi figures after a week or so in this dungeon, I'll be crying and beg him to tell him how I escaped. I'm not going to pussy out. Hell, I got a strong skull. I could do a month in here. I heard a slapping noise against the steel space between the cells. I saw a thin white hand holding a square of paper. I stuck my arm through the bars of my cell door. I took the paper. It was a kite with 2 cigarettes and 3 matches folded inside. It read, "Welcome to Happiness Lane. My name is Coppola. The vine said you're Lancaster, the guy who took a powder 13 years ago. I was clerking in an office up front. I took my powder 1.5 years ago. They brought me back 6 months ago. I've started to cash in my chips 12 times. You'll find out what I mean. I've been right in this cell ever since. I got another year to go with the new time stacked on top for the escape. I've got a detainer warrant from Maine for forgery up front. We're in big trouble, buddy. The prick up front has cracked up 4 or 5 cons in these cells since I came back. There's 6 of us on the row now. Only 3 are escapees. The rest are doing short punishment time, like 2 days to a week. I'll give you background on other things later. I know what screws will get you anything you want for a price. I lit a cigarette and sat on the cot. I thought, Coppola's a hell of a stud to keep his skull straight for 6 months on Happiness Lane. He doesn't know. I'm just here for a few days. That night, we had a supper of sour Spanish rice. I heard the shuffling feet of cons filing into the cell house. They were going into their cells on the tiers overhead. The blaring radio loudspeakers and the lights went off at 9. Over the flushing of toilets and epidemic farting, I heard my name mentioned. The speaker was on the tier just above my cell. He said,
Jim, how about old Iceberg, the Mac Man? Jim, a deuce will get you a saw buck. The white folks will croak 'em down there. A pimp ain't got the heart to do a slat down there.
Jim said,
Jack, I hope the pimp bastard croaks tonight. One of them pimps put my baby sister on stuff.
I dozed off. After midnight, I woke up. Somebody was screaming. He was pleading with someone not to kill him. I heard thudding sounds. I got up and went to the cell door. I heard Coppola flushes John. I stage whispered,
Coppola, what's happening, man?
He whispered,
Don't let it bug you, Lancaster. It's just the night screws having their nightly fun and exercise. They pull their punching bags from the cells on the other side. It's where drunks and old men are held for court in the morning. Buddy, you ain't seen nothing yet. Don't give them any lip if they ever come by and needle you. They'll beat the hell out of you. Then take all your clothes off and put you in a stripped cell. That's one with nothing in it. Just the cold concrete floor. Buddy, there are at least a dozen ways to die in here.
All the rest of the night, I lay staring at the blank, dirty wall in front of me. I wondered what Rachel and Stacy were doing. I had to make contact with a screw to mail some letters on the outside for me. The joint sensors would never let whore instructions pass through. Every few minutes, a screw would pass and flash his light on me. That morning, I watched the cell house cons file past my cell on the way to breakfast and then to their work. All new arrivals the day before were also in this line. That afternoon, I got letters from Stacy and Rachel. They had also sent money orders. They missed their strong right arm. They were working bars downtown. Bet was handling any falls they might take. Coppola, within the first week, hipped me to all the angles of survival. I had a screw who would take letters directly to the girls. He would get his payoff from them. He would bring me cash from them. I got a letter from Mama. I could hardly read the shaky writing. She sent me religious tracts inside it. I was really worried about her. The tight cell and the fear of a year in it was getting to me. The little sleep I got was crowded with nightmares. I was eating good at high prices. I still lost weight. The first month, I lost 30 pounds. Then I got bad news twice within the 5th week. I got a letter from Stacy. Bet had been found dead on his toilet stool at home. It really shook me. He had been a real friend. I got a very short note from Rachel. She was in Cleveland. It said, I ran into an old doctor friend of yours the other night. He was looped. He bought me a drink. Lucky for me, the bartender asked how you were doing. The doctor spilled his guts. He told me about a dead patient of his who came back to life. My worst wishes. P.S. Drop dead. I'll keep the hog. The joint waived the balance of Coppola's time to face the rap in Maine. The skull pressure was getting larger. The cell was getting tighter. With Coppola gone, I was in real trouble the 3rd month. It was like a deadly hex was at work to crack me up. None of the screws would cop heavy drugs for me. I settled for whiskey. I stopped using the safety razor. I didn't want to see the gaunt, ugly stranger in my sliver of mirror. It wasn't just the cell. It was the sights and sounds of the misery and torment on the row and in the nightmares. Mama was bedridden. She was too sick to write. I got telegrams and letters from her friends. They were all praying that I'd get out before Mama passed. I got a pass to the visitor's cage. A screw took me and stood behind me the whole time. It was Stacy. She was pregnant and living with an old hustler. Her eyes told me how bad I looked. Her letters dropped off to one a month with no scratch. At the end of the fourth month, my skull was shaking on my shoulders like I had palsy. A con on the road blew his top one night around midnight. He woke up the whole cell house. At first, he was cursing God and his mother. The screws brought him past my cell. In my state, the sight of him almost took me into madness. He was butt naked and jabbering a weird madman's language through a foamy jib. It was like the talking in tongues holy rollers do. He was jacking off his stiff swipe with both hands. I gnawed into my pillow like the runt to keep from screaming. The next day, I put in a request to see the Nazi. Nothing happened. A week later, I was sitting on the john with my head between my knees. I heard the morning line moving to breakfast. The line had stalled for a moment right outside my cell door. I looked up into a pair of strange, almost orange eyes, sunk into an old, horribly scarred face. It was Leroy. I had stolen Chris from him many years ago. He still remembered me. He stared at me and smiled crookedly as the line moved out. I got my screw to check his rap sheet. The screw gave me the whole rundown. Since 1940, Leroy had been arrested more than 100 times for common drunk. He had also been committed to mental hospitals twice. I was 42. I was 20 when I stole Chris from him. I asked the screw to pull strings to send him to another cell house. I gave him a rundown on the Chris deal and how weak Leroy had been for her. The screw told me he couldn't cut it. Leroy was doing only 5 days for drunk. Leroy had to stay in the cell house. I wonder how Leroy would try for revenge. I had to be careful in the morning for the next 5 days. I had to keep my feet and legs away from the cell door. Leroy might score for a shiv and try to hack something off when he passed my cell. I worried all day about what he would do. Could he somehow get gasoline and torch me? That night, I heard the voice for the first time. The lights were out. The cell house was quiet. The voice seemed to be coming through a tiny grill at the head of the cot. A light always burned in the breezeway behind the grill. The pipes for all the plumbing for the cells were there. I got down on my hands and knees and looked through the grill's tiny holes. I couldn't see anybody. I got back on the cot. The voice was louder and clearer. It sounded friendly and sweet, like a woman consoling a friend. I wondered if cons on one of the tiers above me were clowning with each other. I heard my name and the flow of chatter. I got back down and listened at the grill. A light flooded the corner. It was the screw. I spun around on my knees facing him. The light was in my eyes. He said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "Officer, I heard a voice. I thought someone was working back there." He said, "Oh, you poor bastard. You won't pull this bit. You're going nuts, Slim. Now stop that nonsense and get in that cot and stay there." The cell house lights woke me up. My first thought was Leroy. I got up and sat on the cot. Then I thought about the voice. I wasn't sure now. Maybe it had been a dream. I wondered whether I should ask the screw about it. One thing for sure, dream or not, I didn't want to go nuts. My mind hooked on to what I heard the old con philosopher say about that screen in the skull. I remembered what the books at Federal Prison said about voices and even people that only existed inside a Joker's skull. I thought, after this, when I get the first sign of a sneaky worry thought or idea, I'll fight it out of my skull. Maybe I wasn't dreaming when I heard that voice. If I hear it again, I'll have some protection. I'll keep a strong, sane voice inside to fight off anything screwy from going on. Every moment I'll stand guard over my thoughts until I get out of here. I can do it. I just have to train that guard. He's got to be slick enough not to let trouble by him. I'll make him shout down the phony voices. He'll know they're not real right away. I got up and went to face the bowl. I heard the rumbling feet of the cons coming off the tiers. I was washing my face. I heard a series of sliding bumps on the floor behind me. It was like maybe several newsboys all throwing your paper on the porch in rotation. Then I smelled it. I turned toward the floor. I squinted through the soap on my eyelids. I had been bombed with crap. It was oozing off the wall. The solid stuff had rolled to my feet. Pieces of loosely rolled newspaper were the casings. Cons were passing my door snickering. I felt dizzy. A big lead balloon started inflating inside my chest. I remembered the inside guard. He was new and late on the job. I puked. I shouted over and over, "Watch out now. It's only crap. It's only crap. It's just crap. Watch out. It can't hurt you. It's only stinking crap." A screw stood up at the cell door, twitching his nose. He was screaming, "Shut up!" He opened the cell. I got a bucket of hot water and a scrub brush. I cleaned the cell. The screw asked me who fouled my nest. I told him I didn't know. My screw came to see me at noon. He told me how Leroy had enlisted the crap bombers. Leroy told them I had put the finger on him years ago, when he got the bit for the Papa Tony beating. My screw dropped the truth around the cell house. All the bombers were down on Leroy. I dared him to bother me again. I was safe from Leroy. I didn't mourn when Leroy finished his 5-day bit. It was the end of my 6th month. I beat down worry, voices, and countless thoughts of suicide with my skull guard plan. A friend of Mama's sent me a telegram. Mama had been stricken. The hospital doctors had given her up. Then she bounced back. She was very sick now, but still alive. The telegram gave my skull gimmick a tough test. I had a very sad day around the middle of the 7th month. A booster from New York busted on his 2nd day in town was on the tier above me. A con on my row several cells down called me one night to borrow a book. A moment later, I heard my name called from up above. He came down next morning and rapped to me. His job was in the cell house. The booster asked me if I were the iceberg who was a friend of party time. I told him yes. He didn't say anything for a while. Finally, he told me Party had often spoke of me as the kid he once hustled with who grew up to be Iceberg the Pimp. He told me Party had copped the beautiful girlfriend of a dope dealer when he got a bit. Party turned her out. The dope dealer did his bit. The broad tried to cut Party loose to go back to a life of ease. Party went gorilla on her. He broke her arm. 2 months later, Party copped some H. He didn't know his connection was a pal of the dealer who got the bit. It was H all right, mixed with flakes of battery acid. I didn't sleep that night. I had come to a decision in that awful cell. I was through with pimping and drugs. I got insight that perhaps I could never have hoped to get outside. I couldn't have awakened if I had been serving a normal bit. After I got the mental game down pat, I can see the terrible pattern of my life. Mama's condition and my guilty conscience had a lot to do with my decision. Perhaps my age and loss of youth played their parts. I had found out that pimping is for young men, the stupid kind. I had spent more than half of a lifetime in a worthless, dangerous profession. If I had stayed in school in 8 years of study, I could have been an MD or lawyer. Now here I was, slick but not smart, in a cell. I was past 40, with counterfeit glory in my past, and no marketable training, no future. I had been a sucker than a square mark. All he loses is scratch. I had joined a club that suckered me behind bars 5 times. A good pimp has to use great pressure. It's always in the cards that one day that pressure will backfire. Then he will be the victim. I was weary of clutching quicksilver whores in the joints. I was at the end of the 9th month of the bit. I got a front office interview. I was contesting my discharge date. I was still down for an 11-month bit. An agent of the joint had been in the arresting group. I spent 30 days in county jail before the transfer to the joint to finish out the year. I knew little or nothing about law. I was told at the interview I had to do 11 months. I wasn't afraid I'd crack up serving the extra month. By this time, I had perfect control of my skull. Mama might die in California at any time. I had to get to her before she died. I had to convince her I loved her and that I appreciated her as a mother, that she, and not whore catching, was more important to me. I had to get there as much for myself as for her. I lay in that cell for 2 weeks. I wrote a paper based on what I believed were the legal grounds for my release at the expiration of 10 months. It had subtle muscle in it, too. I memorized the paper. I rehearsed it in the cell. Finally, I felt I had the necessary dramatic inflection and fluid delivery. It was 2 days before the end of the 10th month. I was called in 2 weeks after I had requested the second interview. I must have looked like a scarecrow as I stood before him. I was bearded, filthy, and ragged. He was immaculate, seated behind his gleaming desk. He had a contemptuous look on his face. I said, "Sir, I realize that the urgent press of your duties has perhaps contributed to your neglect of my urgent request for an interview. I have come here today to discuss the vital issue of my legal discharge date. Wild rumors are circulating to the effect that you are not a fair man, that you are a bigot who hates Negroes. I discounted them immediately when I heard them. I am almost dogmatic in my belief that a man of your civic stature and intellect could ill afford or embrace base prejudice. In the spirit of fair play, I'm going to be brutally frank. If I am not released the day after tomorrow, a certain agent of mine here in the city is going to set in motion a process that will not only free me, but will possibly, in addition, throw a revealing spotlight on certain not too legal, not too pleasant activities carried on daily behind these walls. I have been caged here like an animal for almost 10 months. Like an animal. My sensitivity of seeing and hearing has been enhanced. I only want what is legally mine. My contention is that if your captain of guards, who is legally your agent, had arrested me and confined me on such an unlikely place as the moon for 30 days, technically and legally, I would be in the custody of this institution. Sir, the point is unassailable. Frankly, I don't doubt my release will occur on legal schedule. Thank you, sir, for the interview." The contempt had drained out of his face. I convinced him I wasn't running a bluff. His eyes told me he couldn't risk it. After all, surely he knew how easy it was to get contraband in and out of the rotten joint. Getting a kite to an agent would be child's play. I didn't sleep that night. The next day, I got a discharge notice. I would be released on legal schedule. Chapter 22. Dawn. I had amazed cons and guards alike. I had survived it. I was getting out in 24 hours. I was almost 43 sitting in a cell. I thought, I have been in a deadly trap. Have I really escaped it? Does fate have grimmer traps set Can I learn to be proud of my black skin? Can I adjust to the stark reality that black people in my lifetime had little chance to escape the barbed wire stockade in the white man's world? Only time and the imponderables inside me would answer the questions. I had no one except Mama. They dressed me out. My clothes flopped around on my skeletal frame. I still hadn't told them how I had escaped. Cons cheered me as I shuffled toward freedom. They knew how I had suffered and what the awful odds had been that I wouldn't have made it. A friend of Mama's had sent me my fare. As the plane flew over the sea of neon, I looked down at the city where I had come so many years ago in search of an empty, loathsome dream. I thought of Henry and the sound of that pressing machine, of Mama when she was young and pretty. How wonderful it had been back there in Rockford. She would come into my room at bedtime, a tender ghost, and tuck me in warmly and kiss me goodnight. It seemed a long time before I finally got to her. When I walked into her room, death was there in her tiny gray face. Her eyes brightened and flashed a mother's deathless love. Her embrace was firm and sure. My coming to her had been like a miracle. It was the magic that gave her strength. She clutched life for an added 6 months. I never left the house for those 6 months. We would lie side by side on twin beds and talk far into the night. She made me promise that I would use the rest of my life in a good way. She told me that I should get married and have children. I tried hard to make up for all those years I had neglected her. It's hard to square an emotional debt. That last sad day, she looked up into my eyes from the hospital bed. In a voice I could scarcely hear, through her parched lips, she whispered,
"Forgive me, son. Forgive me. Mama didn't know. I'm sorry."
I stood there watching her last tears rolling down her dead cheeks from the blank eyes. I crushed her to me. I tried to get my final plea past death's grim shield. "Oh, Mama, nothing has been your fault, believe me, nothing. If you're foolish enough to think so, then I forgive you." I staggered blindly from the hospital. I went to the parking lot. I fell across the car hood and cried my heart out. I stopped crying. I thought Mama had really gotten in the last word this time. These stinking whores would have gotten a huge charge if they could have seen old Iceberg out there wailing like a sucker because his old lady was dead. Epilogue. I am lying down in the quiet dawn. I'm writing this last chapter for the publisher. I am thinking, how did a character like me, who for most of his life had devoted himself to the vilest career, ever square up? By all odds, I should have ended a broken, diseased shell or died in a lonely prison cell. I guess three of the very important reasons are lying asleep in the bedroom across the hall. I can see their peaceful, happy faces. They don't know how hard and often discouraging it is for me to earn a living for them in the square world. This square world is a strange place for me. For the last 5 years, I have tried hard, so hard, to solve its riddles to fit in. Catherine, my beautiful wife, is wonderful and courageous. She's a perfect mother to our adorable 2-year-old girl and our sturdy, handsome 3-year-old boy. In this new world, that isn't really square at all. I have had many bitter experiences. I remember soon after my marriage how optimistic I was as I set out to apply for the sales jobs listed in the want ads. I knew that I was a stellar salesman. After all, hadn't I proved my gift for 30 years? The principles of selling are the same in both worlds. The white interviewers were impressed by my bearing and apparent facility with words. They sensed my knowledge of human nature. But they couldn't risk the possible effect that a Negro's presence would have on the firm's all-white personnel. In disgust and anger, I would return home and sulk. Bitterly, I would try to convince myself to go back into the rackets. Catherine always said the right things and gave me her love and understanding. There was another indispensable source of help and courage during these hard times. She's a charming, brilliant woman. She had been a friend to my mother. She functioned as a kind of psychotherapist. She explained and pointed out to me the mental phases I was passing through. She gave me insight to fight the battle. To her, I shall always be grateful. The story of my life indicates that my close friends were few. Shortly before I started this book, I met a man I respected. I thought he was a true friend. I was bitterly disillusioned to discover he wasn't. I'm glad in a way it turned out the way it did. I've always come back stronger after a good kick in the ass. I have had many interesting and even humorous experiences in this new life. They will have to wait for now. I see my little family is awake. I'll have to light the heater. I can't let them get up in the early morning chill. How about it? An iceberg with a warm heart. Glossary. Apple, New York City. Bang, injection of narcotics. Beef, criminal complaint. Bell, notoriety connected to one's name. Bill, $100. Bit, prison term. Bite, price. Black gunion, powerful, thick, dark, gummy marijuana. Boo-coos, plenty. Booster, shoplifter. Boot, negro. Boss, very good, excellent. Bottom woman, pimp's main woman, his foundation. Boy, heroin. Breaking luck, a whore's first trick of working day. Bright, morning. Bull scare, blustering bluff. Busted, arrested and or convicted. C, cocaine. Cannon, pickpocket. Can, derriere. Cap, a small glycerin container for drugs. Cat, female sexual organ. Chili pimp, small-time one-whore pimp. Chippied, light periodic use of hairy drugs. Chump change, just enough money for basic needs. Circus love, to run the gamut of the sexual perversions. Coast, somnolent, nodding state of heroin addict. Cocktailed, to put a marijuana butt into the end of a conventional cigarette for smoking. Come down, return to normal state after drug use. Cop and blow, pimp theory, to get as many whores as leave him. Copped, get or capture. Crackwise, usually applied to an underworld neophyte who spouts his hip terminology to gain status. Croak, kill. Crosses, to trick or trap. Cut loose, to refuse to help, to disdain. Damper, to place holding savings, a bank, safe deposit box, etc., to stop or quell. Derby, head, refers to oral copulation. Dirty, in possession of incriminating evidence. Dog, older, hardened whore, or young sexual libertine. Dossing, sleeping. Down, a pimp's pressure on a whore, or his adherence to the rules of the pimp game when a whore starts to work. Fix. To bribe so an illegal operation can go with impunity. Also, an injection of narcotics. Flatbacker. A whore who gets paid for straight sexual intercourse. Freak. Sexual libertine. French. Oral copulation. G. $1,000. Gangster. Marijuana. Georgia'd. To be taken advantage of sexually without receiving money. Girl. Cocaine. Gorilla. To use physical force. Gorilla pimp. No brains, all muscle. Grand. $1,000. H. Heroin. Hard leg. An older, street-hardened, used-up whore. Heat. Police. Or adverse conditions for hustlers. Hide. Wallet. Hog. Cadillac. Hooks. Hands. Horns. Ears. Hype. Addict. Jasper. Lesbian. Jeffing. Low-level con. Jib. Mouth. Keister. Derriere. Kite. Note. Kitty. Cadillac. Larceny. To turn against by vocal condemnation. Lines. Money. Lip. Lawyer. Macking. Pimping. Mark. Victim. Sucker. Mittman. A hustler who uses religion and prophecy to con his victims. Usually the victims are women. Mop. Hair. Muckety mucks. A temptuous term applied to the rich and privileged by the poor and underprivileged. Murphy. Con game played on suckers looking for whores. Nut roll. A pretense at stupidity or unawareness. Okie doke. A con game. Oil. Payoff money to the police. Outfit. Hypodermic kit used by addicts. Pacifier bulb. The rubber top of a baby's pacifier used by addicts to draw up drugs through the eyedropper. Piece. Measurement of narcotics, usually an ounce. Piece of stuff. 1 ounce of narcotics. Pinning. Looking. Poke. Wallet or bankroll. Reefer. Marijuana. Roller. Policeman, usually plain clothes. Roused. Stopped, harassed by police. Shake. Extort. Sheet. Police record. Shield. Badge. Shiv. Knife, usually made by convicts from various objects. Short. Car. Sizzle. Narcotics carried on the person. Slat. One usually refers to money or length of prison term. Slum hustler. A phony jewelry salesman. Smack. Heroin. Snatch. Female sexual organ. Snort. Sniff or inhale. Spade. Negro. Speedballs. A combination of heroin and cocaine injected. Spick. Mexican. Spieling. Talking. A term used by older hustlers and pimps. Square up. Get out of the life. Stable. A group of whores belonging to one pimp. Stall. An accomplice of a cannon. Stand up. To endure or survive. Stash, hiding place. Sting, rob. Strides, trousers. Stuff on, to play on or con. Threads, clothes. Three-way, orally, rectally, vaginally. To pull coat, to inform and teach. Turned out, introduced to the fast life or drugs. Uptight, in trouble, financial or otherwise. Vic, mark, victim. Vine, suit. Whale, throw, usually applied to throwing dice. Wire, information, message, etc. Yeasting, to build up or exaggerate. Yellow, a yellow capsule containing barbiturate powder. Prat, to pretend rejection to increase desire. Peel off, removal of only a portion of money from a wallet or roll. This concludes the reading of Pimp, The Story of My Life, Iceberg Slim. Copyright 1969-1987 by Iceberg Slim. This book was read by Carrie Height. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Cash Money Content, LLC, and was produced in 2011 by Buck 50 Productions, LLC, and Blackstone Audio, Inc., which hold the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Buck 50 Productions, LLC, and Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles, or our monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Or visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.